What if you could harness the power of the free market to solve the problems of poverty, hunger, and inequality? Well, some would say that's impossible, but Nobel Peace Prize winner Muhammad Yunus is doing exactly that. I went to a monastery for a weekend in about 1995 and asked what work I should do. And what came to me was to find a way to ask those with positions of responsibility and some leverage in the world the following two questions. Place yourself a couple of decades in the future. So today that might be 2025 or 2030. And answer this question. Did humanity turn things around? And if your answer is no, you got to live with that. But if your answer is yes, then I want to know how we did it. Looking from the future, how did we turn things around? A year later, I began doing this radio show. Now, as it turns out, I haven't asked that question of many of my guests over the years, maybe about a dozen. But as I was preparing for today's guest, I realized that that is what this interview is ultimately going to be about. As founder of Grameen Bank, Muhammad Yunus pioneered microcredit, the innovative banking program that provides poor people, mainly women, with small loans that they can use to launch businesses and lift their families out of poverty. And over the past 30 years, microcredit has spread to every continent and benefited over 100 million families. Now, in his new book, Creating a World Without Poverty, Yunus pioneers the idea of social business, a completely new way to use the creative power of business to tackle social problems. He asks us to imagine a world in which there are no more poor people. In such a world, when a child asked his or her parents, "I saw the word poverty in a book, what does it mean?" they would reply, "We'll take you to visit the Poverty Museum." It looks to me that he's been asking himself my two questions. Yunus was born in Chittagong, a seaport in Bangladesh, the third of 14 children, educated at Dhaka University, and then awarded a Fulbright scholarship to study economics at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee. He then served as chairman of the economics department at Chittagong University before devoting his life to providing financial and social services to the poorest of the poor. He's the founder and managing director of Grameen Bank, author of the best-selling Banker to the Poor, and Yunus and the Grameen Bank are the winners of the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize. It's an honor and a privilege to welcome you to...
Thank you. It's an honor for me.
Thank you. Now, I have the feeling we could fill more than the whole half hour with your answer to this first question I'm going to ask you, which is, could you share a bit of your path to the work that you're doing today? So since we can't take the whole half hour, can you just briefly, a bit of the story of discovery? Over the years, what questions have you been asking to which microlending and all that has come from that were the answer?
Well, I began back in Bangladesh in 1976 in the context of famine that was going on in the country. And here I am teaching beautiful theories of economics, and I see how useless those conversation was. So I wanted to be useful to people next door to the university campus in the village. So I went there to see if I can do anything for one person, even for a day, just whatever I can do. So I did a lot of small things, and I saw how the loan sharks in the village making their life miserable. So I made a list of the people who were borrowing from the loan sharks. And when my list was complete, there were 42 names on that list. And the total money they needed was $27. So I was shocked by the whole thing. And then I realized that the problem is a very difficult one, but the solution is so simple. If I give $27 from my pocket, they will be free from the loan sharks. That's what I did. Then enormous amount of happiness, you see, that generated in those families. So I asked myself, if you can make so many people so happy with such a small amount of money, why shouldn't you do more of it? So I wanted to do more of it. And one idea came, why don't I go to the bank, which is located in the campus, to lend the money to the poor people in the village next door? When I proposed to the bank said, no, bank cannot lend money to the poor. So I went on arguing with them, their higher officials and so on, for months. They wouldn't do that. So finally, I offered myself as a guarantor. I said, I'll sign all your papers, and you give the money, and I take all the risk. So that's how the whole thing came about in 1976, and it worked. I came out with simple rules and procedures which will make it easy for people to pay back, and they did. And then I kept on expanding and expanding, but the bank was not too enthusiastic about it. So I thought maybe I should have a separate bank for the poor people. And then 2 years of a lot of negotiations with the government, finally authorities allowed me to separate bank to be established. So I did that. It became the Grameen Bank or the Village Bank.
And that's what Grameen means, right?
Grameen means village, Grameen Bank. Now today we have 7.5 million borrowers in Bangladesh. 97% of them are women. They take tiny little loans for income generating activity and change their life.
An example of an activity, an example of a loan.
Loan would be something like, initial loan would be something like $30-$35 to buy some chicken or do some basket making, buy raw materials to do the basket making, or buy some fabrics to make dresses and so on. So very simple thing, people that are familiar with doing, and they can sell this and make money for themselves. These are illiterate women. Never been in business before. Then she never thought she can do something like that. But seeing one another, they come up with ideas and gradually grow. Today, average loan in Grameen Bank would be something like $150. So there are many, many people who take loans above that, but most of them are around that.
Mm-hmm. And so in the past, with the loan sharks, they would borrow the money from the loan shark, and then almost everything they made, the baskets, the chickens, whatever it was,
everything went back to the loan sharks. So the condition, like first person that really gave me the shock, she was making bamboo stools, and a beautiful bamboo stool. And I couldn't figure out why she's so poor if she's making such beautiful bamboo stool. Then she explained to me she didn't have the money to buy the bamboo, so she had to borrow from the loan sharks. And how much was the money she had to borrow from the loan sharks? 25 cents. And the condition of the borrowing is, whatever you produce, you have to sell it to me at the price that I decide. So that means she never gets anything for herself. Everything, she is a slave labor for the loan shark.
So once you have the initiative in that world, once you have the initiative to do something, you actually become a slave.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, because this is a trap you can't get out of, because you don't have the money, and when you borrow the money, the guy who is lending you the money takes away everything, so you still don't have any money left.
God. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Nobel Peace Prize winner Muhammad Yunus, pioneer of microcredit, and we're going to talk about his new book, Creating a World Without Poverty. This is KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. Let me ask one question. When I was reading your biography, I was surprised to realize that you spent some formative years, age 25 to 32, in the U.S., studying and teaching at Vanderbilt and Middle Tennessee State, from formative years for America, 65 to 72. Did those years in America have any influence on what's happened since?
Oh, it is. It was a very useful time that I spent here. This was the time of the civil rights movement. So I saw how the civil rights movement was being fought in this country. This was the time for the flower children, the hippies. This was the time for anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, students fighting against the authorities not to go into Vietnam and also stop war in Vietnam. So all these things were happening. There's this social upheaval going on. And I'm taking sides this way or that way, debating, discussing, and watching it, what's happening in the country. So I learned a lot in the process.
I mean, the fact that you went on to become not just an economics professor, but a social entrepreneur.
Yes, indeed. I saw the social milieu at that time, so how transitions take place, how one idea changes into another idea, how you stand up for those ideas. In the beginning, it looks like you have absolutely no chance, but you keep on fighting and it happens.
Exactly. I actually saw that James Lawson, I think, he had studied, I know, in India, one of the civil rights leaders in America, of the sit-ins, and he'd learned civil disobedience from folks who'd learned from Gandhi.
Yes,
so I like the cross-fertilization.
Yes, cross-fertilization. Peaceful marching for a cause that you believe in what it is.
Yeah. I mentioned the term social entrepreneurship. What is that? Let me put a little more context around it. I mean, I assume you've been a social entrepreneur since before they came up with the term. Some people would say, oh, it sounds like jargon, you know. But I think you find it a useful term and a useful model.
It's one way to describe what people are doing. Many people take initiative in changing the world, changing their neighborhood, changing things the way it is done. So you need a description who these people are. And you are doing it not for your own personal gain. You are doing for bringing gain to the society, bringing gain to the world. So they are described as social entrepreneurs. It could be a very small neighborhood thing, but you are taking initiative beyond the call of your normal duty. You did it because you felt it strongly that it should be done. This needs to be done.
So I know Bill Drayton of the Ashoka Fellows, he says that we've all heard the thing of you can either give someone a fish or teach them to fish. And he says social entrepreneurs change the way we fish.
Yeah, that's right. That's another way of looking at it. Yeah.
When I said this thing about you were probably a social entrepreneur before the term even existed, have there been lessons learned over the evolution of social entrepreneurship that certain things that people thought it wasn't, and that there's some sort of real wisdom that's evolved over time about why it works and what makes it work?
I would say it, when the term is coined and so already used for people describing who are these people, then you start looking at it. One good thing came out of it. In the beginning, you thought you are alone, and this is a kind of odd kind of thing. People look at you, why are you doing this, what's in it for you? Then you didn't have any good answer. But when this term was coined and everybody's introduced this as a social entrepreneur, you see there are a lot of them like you. And you learn from each other. Because you're doing something, some guy somewhere else is doing completely different thing, and it's changing the society. So that brings you the courage and confidence that I'm not alone. There are other guy like me, and there are many things I can learn from them. So this became a community of their own. They inspire each other. I think that's the most important thing that happened.
Yeah, and that makes very good sense. In other words, one social entrepreneur alone is Don Quixote.
Right.
But a bunch of them are a lot of change. The Norwegian Nobel Committee, when it awarded the Peace Prize to you and to the Grameen Bank, it said it was for your efforts to create economic and social benefit from below. And my guess is that means that concept of from below is more than microcredit, isn't it?
Yes, it's more than microcredit. Microcredit is just a platform that you create to other things to happen. For example, we started giving housing loans so that you can build a house. Still, it's a credit. Then we encourage them to send their children to school. Today, 100% of the children of Grameen families are in school. These are all illiterate families. Mother doesn't read and write, father doesn't read and write, but the children are in school. Many of them are now in high school, and many of them in colleges, universities, and Grameen Bank gives them a student loan. And as a result, there are 21,000 students who are in medical schools, engineering schools, and universities, and so on. So you create a completely new generation that's coming out of it. So one after another, and we introduce many different products like a pension fund so that you can take care of your old age. You're a poor person. You worry always, what will happen to me when I grow old? Who is going to take care of me? Because there is no savings for them. So now we said, no, you take care of yourself. You can do that. You could put a little savings on the side, and that money will grow. And out of that, you have an income which will take care of your monthly requirement.
Let's say, although the loans are small, the changes are incremental, the time is long-term, Bangladesh has, in the years, let's see, you say 76, so we're now talking 30 years, has undergone great change, yes?
Oh, a lot of changes. Bangladesh is quite different now than it used to be 30 years back. One thing Bangladesh has dramatically achieved is women empowerment. Situation of women has changed completely because of the programs that were introduced in Bangladesh, like microcredit and other things. And the population growth has come down. The population growth rate has dramatically changed. It used to be over 3%. Now it is less than 1.4%, which is way down. Also, the economy has been growing pretty good. It's a 6.7% growth rate in the economy. And the poverty has come down very sharply. We are one country which will be reaching the Millennium Development Goal of reducing poverty by half by 2015. So we are right on the track, and we are looking forward to achieving it by 2015. Our hope is we can even achieve it before 2015. So it's not something of a slogan that you raise, soon you forget whether you're going to do it or not. But for Bangladesh case, not only will be achieving that Millennium Development Goal of reducing poverty by half by 2015, we are on the track to achieve all the 8 Millennium Development Goals. So I would say that is a fantastic achievement to achieve all the Millennium Development Goals by 2015.
And I believe you said at the very top that in 76, stirred by the famine. I mean, that famine was when Americans and a lot of other people in the world first learned of Bangladesh. And
it was
the poorest of the poor. It was the bottom.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, one thing that I read was that of all the banks in Bangladesh, not even 1% of the borrowers happened to be women. Now, I'm not sure when that was so, and yet you say 97% of Grameen borrowers are women, and it's part of the whole program. Is this idea of women empowerment going to be one of the things that changes the world so that we create a world without poverty?
Oh, it makes a significant difference in third world countries when you empower the women. It changes the society very fast. You change the whole new generation coming up, young girls, young boys. They look forward to completely different thing. I was referring to that 1% of borrowers not being women in the conventional banks in Bangladesh. This was in the 70s when I was struggling with them, trying to persuade and attacking them for being wrong. But the situation for the conventional bank has not changed much even after those 30 years. Still, if you go to conventional bank, probably the percentage would be somewhere around that level, 1% or less.
Yeah. Even though
all the things that we do in Grameen Bank.
And you have a phenomenal repayment rate.
Absolutely. Always. The Grameen Bank has been a very high repayment rate, near 100%, 98%, 99%. You remember Bangladesh is a country with floods, with cyclones, and all the bad news that comes out of it. Despite all those disasters, you remember the Katrina in Louisiana or New Orleans. What a dislocation this has created in people's life. We have that kind of Katrina every other year. In floods and cyclones, but Grameen Bank continues. We have established a procedure by which we can handle that kind of thing.
One of the things that you said in your Nobel speech was you believe that we can create a poverty-free world because poverty is not created by poor people. It's created by a system and a way of thinking. Does the work you've done so far basically demonstrate that?
Yes, very much. First of all, it demonstrates repeatedly that there's nothing wrong with the poor people. Like the children that I was talking about, these children coming from the illiterate, poorest families, and today they're becoming doctors, engineers, and PhDs, and so on. It's already done. So you see the two generations side by side. The mother of this girl, who is a doctor now, could have been a doctor herself, but she's an illiterate person. So there's nothing wrong in the person. So only opportunities make them happen, the different one. The PhD student or the person who got the PhD, his or her mother is still illiterate. Her father is illiterate, but she has the PhD. So that shows poverty is not caused by the poor people. Poverty is imposed on them, imposed by the system that we have created around us. And look at the conventional banking system. It ignores all the millions of people on this planet. I would say almost 2/3 of the world population don't have the privilege of having services from the conventional banks. So what kind of system is that? And then I talk about business, the whole idea of business itself. If you look at it, the theory says business means business to make money. Profit maximization is the goal, is the mission of business. The theoreticians who framed those theories assumed that human beings are like money-making machines. And I keep reminding that human beings are much bigger than just money-making machine. Money-making is an important part of human being, but that's not the totality of human being. Human beings are giving human beings, sharing human beings who go out and do the things for others. But all those things are missing from the...
Well, even the very fact that human beings, I mean, at its most very basic, we grow up in families, we grow up in villages. And neither the family nor the village would work if, in fact, humans were one-dimensional.
Exactly. It's a one-dimensional human being. I said, so you created in your theory some robots, and we are trying to imitate those robots in our life because you were so impressive theory, your theory, so we want to imitate you. And in the process, we destroyed ourselves. And in an insult to the human being, its capacities, I'm saying that to justify the totality of human beings, you have to have another kind of business. Business to do good to people without any intention of personally benefiting from it. Because the business that we know today, the theory that offers today, is all about me. I'm the one. I must get everything I want to. There's nothing for others. So I said, that's where we went wrong. We can have another kind of business. We'll call it social business. It's a non-loss, non-dividend company with a social objective. And we can create it. And you don't. I'm not saying everybody has to go and do that kind of business. If you feel like you want to do something, here is an option. You can do that. So I could use my money to go into profit-maximizing business, and at the same time, I can run and participate in a social business also.
And one of the models you're going from is the fact that some of the wealthy do philanthropy. They contribute to charity. They have foundations.
Yes, there's lots of money. Billions of dollars have gone into foundations. So if you see, the economics doesn't allow you to do anything for others within its framework. So you have to step outside. You become a philanthropist. You go to the charities. If we could create the social business, that will offer us much more opportunity than charity. Charity dollar has only one life. Use it and it's done. Then if you want to do the same thing again, you need fresh money to brought in to do the same thing. But if you can design it as a business, it has that social business money will have unlimited life because it recycles. That's the beauty of a business. Then you can improve, you can reach out, you can bring efficiency and so on. It could be healthcare program, it could be bringing good quality drinking water to the communities which doesn't have any good quality drinking water at an affordable price, or you can bring nutrition to the children. It could bring, in the United States, there are 47 million people without any health insurance. If we could create social business to bring social health insurance for those people, that will be a wonderful thing to happen. And there are many people, millions of people in this country who cannot open a bank account because banks will not let you do that because you're too small. So yeah, as a social business, you can do that.
Let's speak for the next 4 minutes about this notion of social business. I've only begun to see the term in the last few years, as maybe social entrepreneur 20 years ago. Is it really something different? That is to say, if you have a foundation and you do good, what you're saying the difference is that you spend the money you don't expect a return. In a social business, you expect a return, but it's just a return to be reinvested into, which is basically what a lot of startups do anyway. But what you're saying is at no point is the goal to generate profits.
For the investors.
Right.
The company can make profit, but the profit stays with the company. The investors, the owners of the company, must declare that I don't want anything for me in it.
They get a salary.
I can take back my investment money. If I work for the company, I can take salary. That's it. But no profit. I cannot take any dividend. Because the entire company is devoted for a social objective. Either it is improvement of the income situation of the poor people, or it could be slum clearance, or the
education,
nice education, healthcare, drinking water, whatever. That's my goal. I feel bad about it, so I want to address it myself. I don't want to dump everything on the shoulder of the government to do it. As a citizen, I have the capacity, I have the creativity, I can address it as a business.
And you're doing that within Grameen, correct?
Yes, we have been doing so many.
You have a cell phone business?
Cell phone business, most particularly one which we have done with the Grameen and the Danone company. Danone is a yogurt.
Danone
is,
right.
We have done created a joint venture company called Grameen Danone Company in Bangladesh, in collaboration with the Danone of France, to produce yogurt. It's a very special kind of yogurt where we put all the micronutrients which are missing in the malnourished children, there are millions of malnourished children in Bangladesh, iron, zinc, iodine, and vitamin, whatever is missing, we put it in the yogurt and sell it to them at a very, very cheap price. And the company covers its cost. The investors, the Danone and Grameen, they promised that they will never take any dividend out of it because this is geared towards the social objective of bringing nutrition to the children who are malnourished, and is doing pretty good.
And so Danone, a profit-making company in most of its work, has decided in this particular partnership with you, they're not making a profit.
That's true.
And
that's right.
Their shareholders, how do they react to this?
Their shareholders, they got the permission from the shareholders. They circulated the resolution to the shareholders. This money, we will not expect any return out of this. We are doing it for this. If you agree, sign it, we'll put your money. If you don't agree, we understand.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So you could opt out of it?
Yeah, yeah.
As
that's
a shareholder.
Very clear, yeah. Very clear decision.
So let me go back to the two questions I said that I seldom ask. If you could look from 2030, 2035, you can name the year. Did humanity turn things around?
Oh, yes. Humanity will turn things around because things will have very different than what we have today because the world is changing very fast. If you go back 35 years, you wouldn't imagine what will be in 2008. Soviet Union still be there, Berlin Wall still be there, you still don't have a desktop or a laptop or anything of the kind that is, or iPod or whatever you see right now. You won't have cell phones, you never dreamt that the cell phone, but it happened. You don't know what will happen 35 years from today. It will be a completely different world which we cannot even imagine. It will be a Hollywood movie, a science fiction movie kind of thing. So unless we decide what kind of world we want to make, it will be maybe a chaotic world. So let's figure out what kind of world we want so that we can make it happen. You need to imagine before you can create. So let's imagine. And that world will be a world where not a single person will be a poor person. And we'll create poverty museum so that people can go and see what poverty used to be like.
Okay. So the books are Banker to the Poor and Creating a World Without Poverty. The websites are GrameenFoundation.org and MuhammadYunus.org. Thank you, Muhammad Yunus, and
thank
keep
you.
Up the good work.
Thank you for inviting me.